Okay, so my first point is to note my collaborator. This is already a published paper. This study was drawn from a data set I collected in the early part of this decade in Atlanta, a project known as Smart Track. I've published many papers out of this data set, and we have many more still to come. We've got about 20 peer-reviewed papers out of this one project, but it was a huge project. I'll recognize Jacqueline Kerr, co-author, Dori Rosenberg, also from San Diego, and Abby King from Stanford, who I work a lot with on issues of healthy aging. This bridge is aging in a healthy way. Anybody know where this is? Probably the Pont du Gard in the south of France. And I show it as a metaphor because planning and health really need a bridge this strong to last over time. We've really fractured the connection such that in 1996, I go to a conference in Washington, D.C., and I meet someone from the Centers for Disease Control. Actually, it was Rich Killingsworth, you may have heard of. And he says, we're here because we're interested in non-motorized and walking. And I said, why? He says, well, the Surgeon General just released a report. Steve Blair's work had come out showing moderate physical activity was a really important, you know, we had just not just vigorous, but the moderate physical activity chronic disease benefit had really become confirmed in the evidence base. And Surgeon General's report, as we know, in 96 really emphasized that. And then the built environment was soon to follow. So it was interesting because as a planner, I'd been already studying for a decade by then non-motorized travel. There were about five of us in urban planning who had maybe three who had been. Nobody was interested in urban planning and studying walking. They were studying vehicle use. They were studying maybe some transit, but non-motorized was off the radar completely. So here we are 15 years later since that first conversation, and that led to the first study that was ever done that they funded, looking at the impact of the built environment on physical activity that we did. I was at Georgia Tech at the time. So I think about it, and I think on one side is urban planning, and the other side is public health, and I sure hope that we're able to forge a really significant partnership. The aims of this paper are to assess the relationship between urban form, land use, think of it, structures of city, built environment. We have all kinds of words we interchange. They have inherently often no difference in meaning. We're just trying to confuse you. Walking, driving, physical activity, and weight status in a large sample of older adults responding to a travel survey. So these folks in the survey, about 1,970 that we retained for this analysis, there were about 3,100 total that we had of elderly. This is a subset of 18,000 people that we happened to have captured when we did our household travel survey. So we had a large sample in Atlanta, and I thought, why not just select out these people and look at how they react to neighborhood design? Because we have very detailed measures of the built environment. And we also have very detailed measures of their physical activity and other things and their body weight. And the idea is to provide direct, as with anything that I do, and try to encourage my students and colleagues as well. We work together on looking at how to translate whatever research we do into policy. So now why this research seems to be so important, one of the many reasons it's so important is we're right on the cusp of, everybody in the room knows this, we're going to have a lot more people over 65 really quickly, very, very soon. So California, we've got examples from Seattle, I'm sure many of you can draw upon your own regions, where 65 plus population will more than double in the next 25 years, and you can just see what the numbers are, and then the question is, where will they live? And they're going to want to live, a lot of them, at least where there's access to services, need to be less reliant on driving for safety reasons, and they can maintain independence. For elderly, considering cost of service delivery with aging in place is critical. I know under the Older Americans Act, a lot of the projects, Bill Satriano from Berkeley's in the room here, he and I work with Abby King at Stanford. We have two separate R01s. I guess everybody in here knows what an R01 means, right? Underway observational, this is a major five-year operating grant under NIH. They're about $2.5 million each, and we have two right now underway on healthy aging. One of them is done, and we're analyzing the data called the Neighborhood Quality of Life Study Seniors. The other one is underway, we're finishing data collection is done there too, and we basically used a randomized control trial where we had an intervention arm where we're now looking at the moderating effect of the built environment on the results of how effective the intervention was. So that's going to be a longitudinal analysis of built environment effect on physical activity for elderly. Those two are underway, and we were just awarded in Canada an operating grant, a capacity building grant. Canada does it a little differently. So they gave us the equivalent of an R01, and I'm working with Heather McKay in Seattle, and she does healthy aging, and she's in charge of the Hip Center for Hip Health. So it's very active in falls and looking at research on falls, and that's an interesting program to watch because it's a capacity building grant. Over the next 6 years, we will be launching observational studies on that platform, and so we'll be building a lot of evidence in Canada. So Seattle, this is another example in 2000 and 2011, you can see the rate at which elderly are populating the urban core areas is faster than even projected. But the issue is there's probably quite a bit of latent demand for them to be able to move more centrally than they can because of the inflated relative rates of housing prices, and currently with the meltdown in housing and real estate, we have a lot of soon-to-be seniors living in, or seniors already living in, very automobile-dependent environments and unable to move, fixed in location, so there's going to be a real problem. So what we need to be doing is a better assessment of the actual underlying preferences that elderly in particular have. We do this for the general population, understanding people's preferences for neighborhoods and attitudes, because we need to be able to separate out the effect of physical environmental design from the actual attitudinal factors that impact our behavior. So everybody understands this, and so we want to get to causation, which we need from the evidence perspective, to move the action forward, change how we spend money. We're going to need this information, but for seniors, it's particularly important because the argument is very clear. A lot of elderly would like possibly to move, but can't because of the cost. The other side of that is how we design communities, and I'll mention to be on the lookout for a book by former Secretary Henry Cisneros, which Stanford Center on Longevity is releasing on healthy aging, and we contributed a chapter on built environment. But in that book, at the end of writing this whole chapter, I was thinking, what's the most important thing I can think of at the end of all this? And the concept of place, aging in place. And we have all this, many of you know a lot more about this than I do, but the definition and the way we, in our ideology, think of place as being our structure is wrong. It's the community, because we have to be able to smoothly transition between different kinds of dwellings and retain our social fabric. It's also detrimental to people in the community when the elderly have to leave too soon. They're actually often the leaders of your neighborhood and community. I had that happen in Atlanta when the Ford sisters of Claire Drive got moved out too fast, and they were like, well, we looked around the neighborhood. This one, Mary Betty Ford, she used to call me Lawrence. She was Lawrence. I looked around the neighborhood. There's no apartments. We had a single family, walkable neighborhood in Atlanta, but no mixed housing. So this issue of housing mix is critical from a number of dimensions. It has been under-researched. We haven't really done a lot of studies. We've done a land use mix, live, work, play, shop, services, but housing mix and how that affects behavior and mobility has been understudied. So I hope that becomes, and it's actually very researchable. So a little on the methods for this study. It's a cross-sectional study, pretty simple, using a travel survey based in 2001 and 2002 in Atlanta, where we had, I mentioned 1,970 people. The travel survey participants recorded destinations, visited, travel mode, how they got there, the purpose, time of day, over 2 days. This is standard travel survey stuff that's used to calibrate regional travel models. This is what your metropolitan planning organizations are doing every 5 to 10 years to update the models to predict where to invest in transportation. So data were collected. In addition to the travel diary, we did something unique in Atlanta because I happened to have been beneficial to have the Centers for Disease Control at the time at the table. Not that much in terms of funding, because we had gotten through mitigation from the, remember when Atlanta was the poster child of sprawl, so everybody must remember that. That was a really important time because I was able to get this project going, and I just basically steered a ton of the resources into this topic. So it helped. What helped was to be able to say to the Atlanta Regional Commission, the MPO, we need to do this. We need to actually ask. They laughed at me when I said we need height and weight. They were like, you gotta be kidding. We'll never get people's height and weight. And we said, yeah, we'll get height and weight more easily than they'll tell you how much money they make. And travel surveys are based on income. So actually there was some fighting going on, and they're still probably upset about it, but now they claim it as the greatest, you know, as one of the things they've done. So general physical activity levels were self-reported. We did have objectively measured physical activity, but not enough for this study. So methods, just on the geographic, how we measure built environment, we use parcel data, assessor's data. If you own a home, you know what it is, you pay tax, it's there, believe me, they have it. The data exists. And so we build measures of mixed use, I'll just mention street network characteristics is a different type of data. It measures the connectivity, so road networks, you can look at how directly you can travel between destinations. We measure it objectively using geographic information systems. I'll just show you an image, it'll be a lot easier. So on the left, now, is this easier or were the words easier? Just to be sure. Okay, so on the left we have, now there's two main concepts. This is basic, you know, in terms of planning stuff, this is what planners do, but on the health side, this is new. So it's really important that we all develop a common language. This is how planners think of this. Proximity, connectivity, measuring using, you know, you walk out the door of your house, upper left, or if you live in a place like in the upper right, they're very different neighborhoods. This one is single use, low density, and basically, you know, you can't do much other than walk in your neighborhood, but it may be safe to walk in your neighborhood because there's not a lot of pass-through traffic. You may feel safer from crime, you may not be, but you might feel it, and so forth. Upper right, you see mixed use, you've got all the different kinds of uses intermixed together. And the buffer, the squiggly line, is what you can get to within a kilometer out your door, and it's bigger because the road network is more connected. Right? Simple concept, but then we extrapolate objective measures using this information that we correlate with people's behavior. So the question being, if you're over 65 years old and you're aging in a neighborhood like the one in the upper left, and you report how much you walk, how much you drive, versus the upper right, and then we relate that with and control for demographic characteristics to come up with a relationship or an association. A to B, 2 kilometers versus 1 kilometer, and different levels of connectivity. So one measure you may have heard of is connectivity or intersection density. And all we're doing there, it's simple stuff. We're just counting the number of intersections, 3 legs or more, within a square kilometer. Here we probably have about 8, because most of them are cul-de-sacs or just, you know, dead-end streets, versus, you know, maybe 3 times as many in a connected grid. And it's just masking another concept, which is route directness. So what we don't want to have is the requirement for people to have to go, in this case, all the way around. If you live here, you have to go all the way around just to get right here, which may be where you want to go. But we created our communities that way to create what's known as defensible space. A guy named Oscar Newman really coined that term and became the head of housing and urban development for quite a while, I think. And that really was the way we thought it was good to build communities, arguably at the time to promote public health, safety, and welfare. But at the same time, what we now know is, in fact, the requirement that people have to drive, create air pollution, cause risk, actually, for pedestrians and so forth, is actually counter to public health, safety, and welfare. But if you look at the zoning codes and the way we exclude out different uses, those codes are underpinned by health, safety, and welfare. So we have the specter, for sure, that we could challenge at a Supreme Court level the utilization of zoning as a tool to promote public health, safety, and welfare. Because, in fact, zoning is harming public health, safety, and welfare, originally intended in 1926 to separate factories and smokestacks from where people live. Good idea. But now we have different issues. But we haven't changed the tool. So we've got the old tool and the new issues. So here's Atlanta. This was when you take all of these measures, we put them together in a walkability index, and we correlate that with behavior. I'm going to run out of time before I even tell you anything about the study. So anyways, but the good news is the paper's already published. You can read the paper. I can talk about whatever I want. Okay, so anyways, I'll just mention a few things about these numbers. I was just looking them over again myself, but you can see the different age groups, and tells us the percent that walked at least once in 2 days, percent and traveled in a car in over an hour. This is the same study that we showed that driving predicts obesity. This is the data set from which we drew that driving is a predictor of healthy body weight. And then the percent getting moderate and vigorous physical activity levels. And as we walk, as you kind of look through all the different things, there's a lot of systematic relationships that start to appear. I don't have time to go into them, but you might look at that table if you're interested in this study and want to look at the paper. That's a good table to look at. It's simple. Summary of findings. Increased walkability was related with more walking, odds ratio of 2.02, less time spent traveling in a car, 0.53, and lower odds of being overweight. Basically, it was a clean sweep. Everything we thought was significant, if not more significant than we even thought it would be. And that's all adjusting for demographics. Vehicle ownership really matters. Those with one or no cars were more likely to walk. Of course they were, they had to. But and spend, look at that odds ratio. So. I could have told you that. And spend less time in cars, but also less likely to get recommended levels of physical activity. So interesting result. Now, people who have fewer cars, less likely to get recommended levels of physical activity. So access to transportation is important to get to destinations where physical activity can occur for across the population. It doesn't mean that adding cars is the way you're going to promote physical activity and health, or the best way to, but it is true that if you're older and aging in an environment that's unwalkable and you have a car, you may be more active than the person next door to you who doesn't. And we get that. So we have to think about what the strategies really are to solve that while not causing other problems. We also looked at visiting food outlet visitation, because it's a travel survey. We know where people go. And we found that those who went and visited a fast food restaurant were more likely to be obese, significantly more likely. Looking at walkability itself, age, number of cars, ethnicity, and walkability were significantly related to walking at least once over the two-day period. Only 4% of the sample reported walking at all, though. Not a lot. It doesn't mean that only 4% walked. We have very large underreporting of walking in travel surveys. We do everything we can, but if I asked you how you got to work or how you got somewhere and you used transit and you walked to the bus or the train, you forget to report the walk trip. So we have to go back and impute and add the walk link, assuming they did walk. So it's underreported. So GPS data collection on people so we can actually measure where they go is important. 57% of the sample was overweight and 20% were obese, quite high. Those with one or less car, or fewer cars were almost three times more likely to walk. Those with a degree, college degree, were almost twice as likely to walk, and those living in a high walkable neighborhood were two times more likely to walk than those in low walkable neighborhoods. So lots of evidence. And then time in cars, it's a really interesting variable in a number of ways. The youngest group, the 65, now this is really important, is that when we talk about healthy aging, the 65, the age bands, you know more about this and study this than I do, but I know that this is important. So I actually cut the data by decades, and we compared. So the youngest group and those in the higher household income and with a degree were more likely to travel in a car for an hour each day. Those with one car or less, no cars, non-whites and women were significantly less likely to spend as much time in a car, an hour. Those living in neighborhoods with medium walkability were 35% less likely, and those in high walkable neighborhoods, 47% less likely to travel over an hour a day by car. Only those with a car were significantly more likely to meet recommend, again, reinforcing that finding. So it doesn't mean vehicle ownership is the answer, but we have to report what we see. Body weight, increased walkability was related with lower odds of being overweight. You can see the odds ratio, 32% less. Those who walked were significantly less likely to be overweight, of course, and then women and those with a degree less likely, I mentioned that earlier, and then younger participants more likely to be categorized as obese, as were non-whites, and those with no college degree, and those who met physical activity guidelines, again, less likely to be obese. So the implications are many, just a few things that I wanted to note. Policies are needed to bring older Americans closer to shops and services and healthy food outlets as a means of encouraging regular walking and healthy body weight. And incentives to encourage neighborhood grocery stores and affordable housing in central areas, along with regulatory reform through zoning, can encourage physical activity, that's what PA is, and healthy body weight in the elderly. Thinking about the kinds of environments in which we age, we've done a lot of work, this is just to mention as backup, comparing these age groups. And you can just see percent with no driver's license, with a medical condition, with no household vehicle, total daily trips per person, all have systematic trends across the lifespan. And it's important that we think about healthy aging that we treat each group, understand the needs of each group and how transitions between the groups, the age groups, is important. The other piece, of course, is food access. We didn't map food environments in this particular project or test it, but there are very systematic relationships between healthy and unhealthy food establishments. And I won't go into that, but there's been a lot of work on that. And then finally, I need to mention this, air pollution exposure is critical for elderly and healthy aging. More walkable places often have increased concentrations of particulates. And it's really important that we don't solve one problem and create another. The good news is the quickly away from road. This shows a study we released in Environmental Health Perspectives last year, where we took walkability in Vancouver and we layered it on top with air pollution exposure. And what we see is what you'd expect. Some of these more walkable places have increased exposure to air pollution. But right away from roadway edge, the particulates leach out of the air quickly. So policies that guide where assisted living facilities are and incentives for elderly to be able to live on higher floors. In fact, three stories above street level, the particulates are concentrated down near the ground. So density is an answer for healthy aging, because sort of an interesting thing. But you know, then the question is, what about the vehicles that operate in those areas, and can't we have regulations to control that? So with that, I'll make sure we have time for other speakers, and thank you for your interest.